Hello, friends.
Hey, mamas.
Welcome to My Invisible Disease Podcast. We are here to share our struggles and hacks as two moms living with chronic illness.
Tune in and join our community as we share stories and experiences while we sort through the ups and downs of living with invisible disease. Hey, girl.
Hey, girl.
Oh, you got some pep in your step today.
I know. I have just been out sick, so I'm finally feeling human again. It's exciting.
Well, I'm excited for this episode because we have Heather Russell Kay, who is all the way across the pond in the UK, and we got to learn a little bit about her early diagnosis with MS. Tune into the rest of the episode because you're going to love this girl. She's so funny. Heather, we are so excited to have you on the podcast today to share your story a little bit.
Yes, Heather is a teacher and actor who is diagnosed with MS in 2014 at the age of 24. So, Heather, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story?
24, that seems young for a diagnosis.
And I can't believe it's already been like 9 years, which is crazy.
Oh my goodness.
Absolutely crazy. But this is one of the things that has kind of like made me want to kind of share my story a bit, because most people do say that. I even had a nurse a couple of years ago that when they heard that I had MS, they were like, "You're too young to have that." And I was like, "But you're a nurse." you'd expect the nurses to know this. But no, it is mostly diagnosed from people between the age of 20 and 40, which I had no idea about.
Yeah, and interesting.
It's one of those things that when I was first diagnosed, they were like, everyone knows someone with MS, but I knew absolutely no one. I had no idea about the condition or that it was actually diagnosed quite young in people at all.
I think that there is definitely a misconception when it comes to MS. The only reason I speak to this is because I have a client that has MS, but recently one of my friends has been diagnosed with MS and she's 36. I thought, aren't you too young for that? And no, it predominantly affects women in the earlier years. So
my sister actually has MS too. And her diagnosis, she had, I think she was about 32. And it was due to when she was pregnant, she had come off some medicine. I mean, it was smoking pot, which had been suppressing her symptoms. So then she was pregnant, came off it, and then was diagnosed. So it's interesting that, you know, we actually, I mean, other than you, Heather, who had the diagnosis, but that we do both have people close to us that have MS as well. I think it's quite prevalent in Canada. I don't know if it's environmental factors that contribute, but.
Right. Because you're joining us from the UK.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Really cool.
And they do say that kind of like the further away from the equator you are. Something to do with the sunlight, they say, is a contributing factor. And I imagine Canada's a bit like England with the fact that it's still sunny all the time.
No, it's cold. And no matter where you are, I mean, we get full winters. So,
yes, there's definitely more gray days than sunny days.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But, yeah, so even though it was 9 years ago now, it seems a long time ago, but also not that long ago, because I was exactly halfway through my teacher's training, and I trained for 2 years because I'd already done my degree. So I just did a couple of years where I was studying to become a teacher, and I'd passed my first year, so I was really, really happy that I'd kind of hit this milestone, and it was the summer holiday. And then pretty much exactly a week after I'd finished, I started getting weird tingly sensations, which I think is quite common as one of the first symptoms.
Was it in your legs?
It was in my legs.
Yeah.
You already knew, or you were like, had you heard?
That's just how it was for my friend. My friend said her legs started going kind of numb and whatnot.
Yes.
The eyes on yours was similar.
And definitely, I think for my sister, it was tingling as well. Yeah, interesting. Yes.
And at first, because I'd never heard about anything like neurological conditions, I was convinced that it was blood clots and I was going to die of a stroke or a heart attack. Because that's all I could link the tingling to, was, you know, when you get
circulation. Yeah, that's 100%.
But then I would get weird tingles in both legs at exactly the same time. And I'd be thinking, if it is a blood clot, how is it getting round so fast? Like, to kind of be both legs at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
And people were saying to me, drink lots of water because it was coming to the summer. So maybe I wasn't drinking enough. And I had blood tests and they all came back fine. So it just kind of went down as one of those strange things.
So how long did it take them to start doing like any type of like scans? Because I think that they typically look for a lesion to diagnose, right? How long did that take?
It didn't take too long, but I had to really push for it because over that summer, the tingling then progressed into my hands. Then I pretty much got numbness everywhere.
Oh, wow.
And I never know how you say it. I'm not going to try and say it, but the thing where you put your head down and you get like a shock through your body, coordination went, the eyesight was going blurry. Then I had severe vertigo and ended up in A&E because I couldn't keep fluids down. And it was just the most frustrating time of my life because I got diagnosed with inner ear infection, then a trapped nerve, or maybe I'd hurt my neck.
Ooh,
and then at the end of the summer, they decided that I was stressed. And I was stressed by that point, to be fair.
Yes.
But I was like, it definitely isn't the stress that's led to all of these symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the doctor really wasn't interested, put it down to stress. And she said, well, if you want to, I can refer you to a neurologist, but it will take months for them to see you. And you just look very highly stressed at the moment. So I actually, in the end, went privately and saw a neurologist who within 5 minutes was like, no, you're right. It looks like MS. Because by this point, I had done
like research some of your symptoms. And, you know, I think that's something that is so worth kind of having a quick conversation about is when you go in with symptoms and you kind of get blown off by doctors. I feel like I had actually had an experience where in my chart, it was, she had written something down. And when my husband went in to see the same doctor, he asked if I was always, is Jenny always that way? As if I had been hysterical. And like, not only is that a huge breach of privacy.
Yes. I was honest, thinking that's not allowed. Because
he's just a separate appointment. Like, he shouldn't even know necessarily if I'm going in. No. Honestly, like he did. But, you know, the stress, you know, women being somewhat like hysterical or overreacting, I think is such a... It's still so ingrained in our medical system. So, you know, I'm really sorry to hear that you had that experience as well, where it just wasn't, you know, what's the common denominator? Is it, and that stress was, I mean, stress can cause symptoms, but that it would take so much through the conventional system to get you to a specialist. But
this is good for you for advocating for yourself, because, you know, some people be like, oh, you're right, I am just stressed, or, you know, and, but like actually like digging and finding the true cause and doing that for yourself, like probably had to shell out a pretty penny to get some private healthcare.
And when you did reach out, sorry to interrupt. When you did reach out to the specialist at that point, did you have it in your head that it might be an MS diagnosis?
I 100% knew it was.
Okay.
It also kind of made me a bit annoyed at the doctors because it meant that I had to go through the diagnosis process basically on my own with the computer, which in that case, it was a good thing because if I hadn't sort of spent weeks researching, MS was literally the only thing that fitted all of my symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But it also meant that I got all the really scary stories and at the same time, no one was doing anything. So that part was kind of horrible. I don't think I've ever been as scared as I was during that time, just because you do get the worst case scenarios. But I've heard it so many times from other people that if you're a young woman, it seems to be very easy for the doctors to say, well, you're young, you look fine on the outside. Mm-hmm. It's going to be stress.
Yeah.
Your period.
Yeah.
No, I can definitely relate to the rabbit hole that is looking for the solutions. Like myself, I am mostly undiagnosed as well. And mine started with like muscle soreness and muscle weakness and, you know, progressively got worse and worse and worse. And as you're like trying to figure out what the hell's going on, you Google this symptom and then you Google this symptom. And then it's one thing after another. And now it's like,
you put these like worst case scenarios in it. And honestly, like for me, like one of them that I was terrified of was MS or like ALS. ALS is terrifying as well. Like,
yes.
You know, and like, I don't have that. Like, I don't have the lesions to show that I have MS, but, it was something that I was fearful of. And now you've been living with it for nine years, right?
Yeah, which seems crazy.
So how has that been going? Like, what's changed for you in the last 9 years? Like, how has that been going?
I think the main thing has just been the fatigue, which I think most people with chronic illnesses do experience. That is definitely not a MS individual symptom. I think most people do. And it does just make everything much, much harder because everything has to be very carefully planned. Mm-hmm. If you've got one busy day, then I know that the next couple of days are going to be pretty much wiped out. Yeah. So everything has to be so carefully organized so that I know, right, I'm using up this amount of energy and I should be able to get away with using that much.
the energy bank.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, has to be carefully monitored.
And the fact that you were in school to become a teacher, I think you were actually, without knowing it, already preparing with some of these skills in the best type of way. How did that affect going back to school in the fall for your second year?
Well, my second year was, I don't know how I got through it because at that point I wasn't diagnosed. I was getting over this extreme vertigo, but I also had like the tingling and tiredness. But I knew that I needed to get a certain amount of teaching hours and pass a certain amount of exams and essays to get through the year. I have no idea. I remember there were some days where I'd literally would be on a break during the class and I would just go and lie on the floor in the disabled toilet. It was awful. But I found out quite quickly that as long as I did my hours and I got the essays in, I would be able to pass. So I didn't go to many lessons, but I did my lessons that I needed to get the hours and I somehow got through. And yeah, I was really pleased with myself because I passed with like the top mark as well. Somehow. I have no idea how, but I did it and it was really hard. But yeah, I'm glad that I somehow did it. I'm not sure I'd tell people to do what I did because I felt terrible that year. Yeah. But I'm glad that I pushed through and somehow got through it.
And well, now you are an entrepreneur. You're running your business. How's that translating into building your business?
For me, I think the best thing I did was going self-employed because I realized that I was literally teaching and sleeping. And that was it. And I was only doing part-time, so I wasn't even doing full-time, but it was taking up all my energy. Mm-hmm. And then going self-employed just means that, yeah, I have complete control. So I could decide when my working hours are, how many working hours I want to take on. And also, as I am tutoring, if there is a day when I feel absolutely awful, it's not quite as bad as counseling as it is when you have to phone into a school and be like, I'm not coming in. You realize they've got to cover all these lessons. With my own students, I can just be like, can we pop it to tomorrow? But most of them are fine about that. So going self-employed for me was a really, really good choice.
And do you do most of your tutoring online?
Yes, I do now. I used to go to people's houses, but since COVID, at the beginning the first lockdown, online.
Well, and I was going to say for having chronic illness, cutting out the commute and having to get ready, you know, that can really have a huge impact. Be able to show up.
Yes.
Like, I have sweatpants on right now.
Hey, me too. I wore a nice shirt though.
Yeah, me too.
No, I do exactly the same. So it also means if there's a day where I'm not feeling great, I'm at home. Yeah. So most of the time I don't need to cancel because there has been a few times when I'm in my pajamas and I'll find a nice jumper to pop on the top.
Yeah.
I'm like, right, I'm good to go. This is absolutely fine. Do my bit of work. Most of them have a little break in between, then tuck up into bed for like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Then do the next one. And I think that's made a huge difference because I didn't really notice how much the commute was actually wearing me out. But I'd literally go to one place, then be in the rush hour to go to the next place, which would take 45 minutes. Being at home has been lovely.
But also, it's nice how that protects your profit margin because I don't know about where you're right now, but like gas, you're super expensive.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, if I can do a little bit more online and a little bit less driving around, I am happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're both self-employed as well. I wish that, you know, that more people that were living with chronic illness for, I'm in Canada, I'm not sure about in the UK, but, you know, benefits and different things like that can get a little complicated when you're self-employed. Yes. So, and, you know, of course, in the US too, I think with like health insurance and different things like that. But, you know, the flexibility is just something that there's nothing to match it. So, because very much, you know, I can go have a nap after this if I need to, and, you know, it all works out. Yeah.
It makes such a difference, but it is such a hard thing to juggle because you need to put your health first, but then at the same time, we all need to pay our bills and mortgages and things. So it is really, really difficult.
Yeah. Well, can okay, I
have a question. I got a juicy one, I think, Jenny. Sorry to catch you off, girlfriend.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, so 22 you were when you got diagnosed?
24.
Were you in a relationship at the time or single?
I literally had got into a relationship about 2 weeks before the tingling started.
Oh, it gives me tingles.
The timing was unbelievable.
Yeah. So how did that affect like the relationship? Did you continue that relationship? Did you continue to date? Where are you at now? Like, what, how does that affect? Because you were so young. Like, I can only imagine how that goes. So
he was absolutely amazing because, it was literally 2 weeks. We had been friends for a little bit before, so we'd kind of known each other for about 6 months before we actually got together. But it was about 2 weeks when the tingling started. And then about a month after that, we went away for a little weekend, and that's when the vertigo hit, and I ended up in A&E. So our first little weekend away was in the hospital with him holding my hand, and I had the biggest baby ever. So they had to put a drip in. And I spent the whole time being like, I can't look at my arm.
Yeah.
When seeing the needle coming out. So he kind of saw me at my worst because with the vertigo, I won't go into details, but there was quite a lot of sick as well and stuff.
Yeah.
And he stuck through that. And even through like my diagnosis and coming from my lumbar puncture and things, he came and like held my hand in the hospital. Aww. It was amazing. And we are now engaged.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
So he's still That's around.
Wow.
He's still around. So I was really lucky, but I definitely did kind of feel the impact because he never made me feel bad or anything about it. But I felt bad that I couldn't do more at the beginning because at the beginning, the birth code was really, really bad. So I didn't have the option of being like, oh, let's just go out today and do something completely random. Everything was like, oh, I can only really go out. Well, the first summer I could do anything because of the dizziness. But even then, it was like just a couple of hours at a time. So I always felt a little bit guilty that we kind of didn't have that bit at the beginning where we could literally just go away or go out and I didn't have to think about chronic illness stuff.
Well, I think that's kind of part of it, right?
The guilt that, I mean, even like I'm in the parenting and like my husband and I are married.
Yes.
And there's always that guilt of not being able to keep up with everything. And I think when you have chronic illness, absolutely, when you have a bad day, at some point we got to let that go a little bit too. So, and it's always, that's amazing when you have a partner that has compassion and empathy and understands and, you know, sees your value beyond diagnosis. So that's really cool. I didn't know you guys were engaged. So that's but lovely.
I found a good one.
Yeah.
When he stayed through that first summer and was like holding my hand through the lumbar puncture and stuff, I was thinking he can't be too bad.
Well, you got through the hard stuff, right?
Yeah. It's kind of the thickness bit at the beginning, isn't it?
Yeah. my question was going to be, so you were diagnosed, you had no one that you knew that had the same diagnosis as you. Like, where did you seek out support? What did that look like for you as you moved through, you know, that transition of diagnosis, you know, looking into, you know, what now?
I think I did loads of research at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So I did the typical super, super, super healthy diet, meditation every day, yoga every day. I kind of got a whole little package together. And the next 2 years, I potted through convinced that I would be one of those people that I'd had my initial symptoms and that everything was going to be fine. First 2 years, so I struggled through the symptoms, but I was convinced that nothing else would happen. And then because of that, I kind of stayed away from any online communities and things because I feel really bad saying it, but I would see someone with MS in a wheelchair and I'd be like, oh no, that's too scary.
That's not going to be me.
That's not me.
Yeah, yeah, I would just, 100%. I would find it too much. So I kind of went into, in my mind, I'd accepted it, but now I can see that I was in a denial.
Yeah.
Of, it's been a bad summer, but that's going to be it.
Yeah.
I heard this quote and it was like, it's called protecting your peace. Everyone's saying 2023 is the year of protecting your peace. And I can see that that's kind of what you were doing in that moment.
Yes.
Like, I'm going to deal with this, but like, I don't want to hear nothing else about it. Like, I got this.
Yes.
We're good.
That was it. And then after 2 years, though, I then had a relapse. So my brain was like, wait a minute, the plan has failed. And I think that was kind of when I realized I did need to seek other help because my mental health suffered really, really badly. So I'm also very much, even though I try and raise awareness for MS, also kind of the mental health side as well, because my anxiety just, the level was ridiculous. I even found it hard just going outside or anything because I no longer trusted my body at all. I was like, what if I go outside and I just fall over or something? And it was one of those things that for the first year I was very much, I can manage this, I could still, like you were saying, kind of protecting my peace, like just carry on, ignore it, it's all right. But it really, it was completely out of control. So I did end up having to kind of get medication for it, and then I also started reaching out to other people. So that I realized there was other people going through the same things and it wasn't just me.
Yeah, I can completely relate to that. It's the idea of like not trusting my body, because same thing. I was like, I know I'm diagnosed, but I'm not going to be that person. And then it progressed and I was like, you betrayed me to my body, right? Like there's a sense of betrayal and trust that you have with your physicality that you're just like, wait a minute, I don't identify with this. This isn't me. Like,
I had a situation where my best friend and I took the kids for like a wilderness walk, and like hiking and like going for a walk is like something I do on the frequent. Like that is like that's my jam. And we had gone for this walk and there was so many mosquitoes. I don't know if you have mosquitoes in the UK, but they're the little devils and they bite you and it's the worst. So we're like trucking through the forest as quickly as we can because they are so bad. And I've packed no bug spray, but like I was not in a great physical condition. So I actually ended up tripping and just like on a route. And like my girlfriend was up ahead with my older son and she heard the fall and comes running back like, oh my God, are you okay? I was like, yeah, I just need help up because there's no way to get myself up. And in that moment, it was just like, okay, like pretend that you're not like completely shook about this. But like in my head, I'm like, I can no longer trust myself to go for a fucking walk by myself. Like the reality of the situation is I probably would have taken like 10 minutes to get up. I would have been eaten alive by the devils that are sucking the blood out of me.
Yeah.
And like, but like in that moment, I was just like, oh my God, like, can I go for a walk by myself or am I going to fall and be like stranded on this trail until someone comes to find me? So like, I get not trusting your body and like, that is not a great place to be. That's not a great headspace.
It is absolutely horrible because I wasn't on the walk with the mosquitoes. So at least I did, I avoided the mosquito part, but kind of the same thing happened because I was on the underground and I got off the train, but you have to go through the tunnely bits and then come up. And my legs just completely stopped working when I got off the train. And it has never happened since. We're going back 7 years now, but I will never forget that my body just stopping. And you think, how has it got to this? How do I not have more control over me? And losing that trust, is just horrible. And it does kind of, it takes a long time to kind of start to just kind of learn more about kind of what's going on and how to manage it. But I think that knowing that that can always happen is very, very hard.
What have you been doing to manage it?
Mm-hmm. I did go on the medication, which I denied for so long. I was one of those people that was like antidepressants and stuff. I didn't want anything to do with. I was completely convinced that I could manage everything naturally. Mm-hmm. And I think natural things are amazing. But I think with me, it just got to such a level that mm-hmm. it was kind of out of my control. And then also that was impacting the MS because I was so anxious all the time.
Yeah.
So it just kind of went round in a vicious circle. So I did end up taking medication, but still kind of doing like the yoga and meditation and just kind of building up the confidence. Because at the time, it's like 26, 27, and I was like, this is ridiculous. But every day I'd be like, right, we're going to walk around the block on our own. We're going to do it. Just literally a 10-minute walk around and just very, very, very slowly.
Do you find, especially if you're out walking and doing things like taking the train, and do you find when, because MS in a lot of ways is invisible, and people, so they look at you and they would assume that you're relatively healthy, and like, has that had an impact for you with, I mean, I know for both podcasting and I, it's that idea that, you know, on the outside, we look really healthy. And that I think can also be a bit of a mental struggle because it's almost like you want to announce to the world, like, hey, this is what I have. Don't like stop having higher expectations of me physically. But also, you know, at the same time, we do such a, I think just naturally we mask it too, to try to act and be as normal as possible. Whether that's to not burden other people or just because, you know, culturally, it's just, it makes you stand out in a way you don't want to. But have you had any experience with that with MS?
I think I do the typical thing of trying to pretend like everything's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember there's been a couple of times where I felt really bad. And then I'm sat in the bit at the front of the bus and you get the looks. Mm-hmm. And I just look out the window and I'm thinking like, you don't understand how terrible I feel. But at the same time, it's you don't kind of want to say anything. You kind of want to, or I always kind of want to appear like everything is fine.
Yes. Yeah,
it's really fine. Balance. How many times do you just, I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine.
Mm-hmm. But it's a really hard balance because sometimes you're really not feeling fine, but mm-hmm. you're trying to look like on the outside like you're feeling fine. And I think that is one of the hardest things is kind of people learning that actually you can look fine.
Yeah.
But there can be a lot of stuff going on because I have my blue badge, which means that I can park in the disabled spaces.
Yeah.
But I'm well aware that I do get quite a few looks because I get out of the car. And I do look fine. And the thing is with MS, especially if I'm not relapsing, I can probably potter into the shop quite fine.
Yeah.
But after I've been out for a little while or kind of the supermarket, mm-hmm. I'm exhausted and I really need to be nearer in that car parking space. But I'm so aware that people will look at me and be like,
that's something I've avoided. I think I have the option to get like the disabled badge for the car just because I'm like waiting for transplant. But because I feel okay enough that then I look okay enough to like go to Walmart or somewhere and walk in. But it's so true. Like the effort sometimes of the energy levels, like, cause energy is one of my big things is like, you're just so exhausted after having to carry all the groceries to the car, like far away. It's like, oh, that would be nice. But it's the judgment. Like
this is there. Cause I am well aware that when I do park in them, I'll avoid eye contact.
Yeah. Yeah.
Head to the car. Don't look up.
Which, I mean, I think we bring on a bit of that. We're assuming people are judging and they might not be, there are some people that are just ignorant and that are like, you know, you don't look sick enough to be using that spot. And it's like, you have no idea what's going on.
This thing. So I think people, it's kind of raising the awareness that actually a lot of people look fine, but have a lot going on. Because I can't remember the statistic, but it's really high for people mm-hmm. that have chronic illnesses and different things. Mm-hmm. And you kind of think, you don't know about it until I kind of got involved in this community and everything. Yeah. I had no idea that so many people were living with these conditions.
Well, I was just about to look it up and I'm like, oh, my computer keys will be so loud. But
it's quite high.
It is so high. And I, because I've looked that up as well, like the statistics of people living with chronic illness, like I swear it's like breaching 60% of women.
60% is a number that's in my head because I think you told me that.
So. Yeah, like it's insane. And obviously, like the chronic illness in many different ways, it could be, you know, some things maybe more intense than others, but this is a shared experience and all, and no one's really talking about it still.
No, this is the thing. And in a way, I kind of understand like where people are coming from, because until I got MS, I was one of those ignorant people.
Yeah.
And I hate admitting it now, but I definitely was. I had no idea. I just assumed that you would be able to have some sort of visible sign. And it never even occurred to me that one day you could be fine and then your body could be completely out of whack and doing crazy things that you'd never have thought about.
Oh my gosh. And that's, isn't that the truth? So, for some people, it's one day you're fine and then the next you're not. And even when you're dealing with chronic illness, as you said, it would, you might have good days, and then a bad day hits. And it's like,
this is the thing.
Night and day, right?
So Heather, I have a question for you. I feel like I just like keep asking you all these juicy questions. Maybe it's because I'm a little bit jealous of your youth and how young you are.
Oh no! Yeah. You don't look any older than me.
I think you're only about like 3 years older.
I feel like I'm like 100.
No,
yeah.
No, don't worry. I feel like that too some days.
Me too.
So you are engaged. How does like the future look? Like, are you guys planning on having a family? And like, how does your diagnosis like? Tell me more. Like,
planning.
How does that affect that? And really also, I need to note that I do not think every woman should have children. So I'm not saying, hey, you're a girl, you should have kids, because I don't think that's necessarily right. But like, is that something that you've considered? And like, does your diagnosis maybe change that a little bit?
I think so. It's definitely something we've considered a lot. Because when I was younger, I did always want definitely to have like one child. But the diagnosis definitely kind of puts more doubts in my mind, only because we're both self-employed, me and my partner. And there's kind of the balancing the money side of things, but also the energy side of things.
Yeah.
And I know no life looks how you plan it. And even though I'm not a parent, I imagine it doesn't look exactly how you plan it.
Never. Because, even when you're healthy.
No, yes, there's a whole new little person. Of course it's not. But in my mind, I always had this idea that, oh, I'd have this like little child and I'd be the perfect mum and we could go and do lots of things and I could take them to London and show them the dinosaurs at the Natural History Museum and do like all of those science museum sleepover things and all of that stuff. And then it's like, I can't do that. Like, that wouldn't really be so much of an option. So it definitely makes the decision harder because I'm kind of like, I don't know how much my fatigue would impact them, but also how much it would impact me.
Well, I can tell you this. Your kids are a little more versatile. And if you decide that you're going to have a family, they'll adapt. But I was super curious to know how like those big decisions come because I got sick after I had kids. I didn't have a choice. But you know what? They're all still alive and we're all
just good. So.
Yeah. Well, and that's like, I mean, even for myself, we knew having kids that there was a 50% chance of them having my disease.
Right.
But at the same time, I had no symptoms and I was told by the doctors it may never affect you. So the actual like rationalizing that decision didn't mean what it means now. And I mean, it's funny, I just have a belief that my kids don't have it. Like, I just truly don't believe they do. But it's interesting to look back of how, where our minds were at, because I had no symptoms, life was great. And then I ended up having a full hysterectomy at 30. So, I mean, we did have two kids before that, but like, let's just say I hadn't met Ryan and I hadn't been married, you know, like that, then it would have looked completely different if I had met someone in my late 20s or 30s. So it's and I think so many women, like, this is a part of it. Like, this is a part of it that we don't also talk about very often because, you know, there's these visions with like going to the, you know, the, to see the dinosaurs and these different things that we bring into things. And, you know, now I'm kind of moving through that. I had a bit of trauma when my mom had a liver transplant and I was older when she had a kidney transplant, but now my kids are going to experience that. And I'm thinking like, I have to pick up and leave for 3 months if that happens. And it's like, ooh, like this is, I didn't even think about that and that there's trauma there and how it would affect them and stuff. So, you know, it's one of those things that I think also is good to talk about because these are hard decisions. And I think, with youth, it is, like, we're probably a little bit, I mean, I'm older than Cassie, so I'm older than both of you guys.
Yeah, you're so much older than me, like at least 2 years.
You don't look much older.
That's because she eats healthy and takes care of herself.
Oh, it's makeup. So if we're kind of swinging back, Cassie, do you want to introduce kind of our segment on...
Okay. So in the UK, do you have a game that you might know called Marry, Fuck, Kill?
Do you know that game? Okay.
So we tried to clean it up a little bit and we changed it to Marry, Cheat, and Screw. So I'll give you the baseline. So Marry is something that you're like, it's your tried and true self-care. Like you love it. It will carry forward with you for a long time. Cheat is more of like a guilty pleasure, fad kind of thing, and screw, you're just like over it. Like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm not into it. So, if you had to marry something, what would it be?
This one's easy because it would be nap time.
Love it. Oh my gosh.
This would be so easy good. Because that has stayed with me since the diagnosis mm-hmm. to now. Even if I could just catch a 20-minute nap with my blanket, there is nothing better.
Naps are so underrated. We all need more rest.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And you feel so safe just snuggling up and tucking up and just shutting out the world for just... Yeah, a small amount of time is what gets me through a lot of days.
I get it. Love a good nap. So then, like, cheat would be a short-term, like, trending, like, something that you're not as tired. What would you say?
Oh, this was a bit harder because I think I live on the naps. I suppose a cheat would be just when I'm having, like, a down day. And then the ice cream and chocolate comes out.
Mm. Yeah.
Which will probably stay with me forever, but I try to limit those days where it gets a bit excessive.
Yeah. Do you find that after you've indulged a little too hard that your symptoms are worse or anything like that or no?
No, I'm quite happy.
There you go. Just super pumped about the ice cream and chocolate.
I just realized that if I carried it on every day, then probably it wouldn't be so good.
Yeah. Totally. Okay, and last but not least, what are you killing in 2023? Like, what are you over?
I think I'm always a bit like, with this sort of thing, because I know with chronic illness, everyone reacts completely differently to things.
Yeah.
But for me, it is really restrictive diets. Because I've tried a couple of them, and it makes it really difficult to eat. I'm always trying to put weight on, because I'm quite little, so it makes me smaller. And it's just not as nice. I love my food. And I try to go around the supermarket and look at the back of all the packaging to make sure that everything's all right. So diet-wise, I am really good with, because I think it is important, but just not the kind of literally looking at every single food for every little ingredient.
Well, and you have to have some indulgence. And I think there's something to with balance and picking your battles.
I think so too.
Moderation.
I completely agree. So that would be the thing. Healthy eating, but not to the extreme.
And then Heather, you tell us a little bit about like what you're doing for advocating? Because I know you have a blog. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, my little blog that I created when the anxiety hit. So the two years afterwards, and I was at home. I had to take a couple of months of work and I had my little donkey dizzy. So we started our blog because I thought, I'm sitting at home miserable. I feel terrible. And I thought, I'm just going to do something that would make me happy. So I would go out into the garden and take Dizzy and take pictures of her doing different things in the garden. And it just kind of grew from there. And madly, people seem to quite like Dizzy. And it's carried on from there. So I do like my blog and I do quite a lot on like social media as well. And also I got into volunteering with the MS Society and Shift.ms, which I love doing because it's lovely to connect with other people as mm-hmm. well. So all of those things are a huge part of my life that has really made my journey easier. Mm-hmm. But I also hope that sharing my story kind of, even if it helps just one other person, I just think that is amazing if it makes someone else's journey a little bit easier as well.
So if somebody is listening to this podcast right now and they just received their MS diagnosis, what is your takeaway from this? Like, what's your message to that lady? It could be a guy too, but it's probably.
I think the first thing would just be to breathe, take a mm-hmm. moment, because MS is really, really scary when you get first diagnosed, but it's not the end of the world. Like, life mm-hmm. does change. And in a lot of cases, it can be a bit harder, but it definitely does not mean that that's it. Like, you can still follow mm-hmm. your dreams or follow new dreams and do lots of different things. And just to do your research and make sure that you are following the path that you want to, because sometimes you can get not so much pushed, but like gently persuaded into certain medications and different things. So I think it's just, yeah, kind of being your own person and kind of doing the research and looking after yourself in the way that works for you.
Awesome. Thanks so much for being on the podcast. And, you know, we will have links in the show notes to carry on the conversation and where to find Heather's blog. So thanks for listening.
Hey, mamas, we see you. And we want you to join our Facebook community where we can connect and continue the conversation.
Join our private Facebook group at My Invisible Disease, because no one should go through this alone.
Thank you for listening and check us out at myinvisibledisease.com.
At least once a week, make some kind of broth. So whether that's a veggie potassium broth or a chicken broth or a bone broth, I use my Instant Pot and it is so convenient. I stick it in there for 2 hours in the pressure cooker, and it's as if it sat in a slow cooker for like 12 plus hours. So it saves me so much time and it's so convenient just to be able to grab that broth and sip on it throughout the day.
Okay, I have an Instapot and I have not made broth yet, but oh, I actually want to get into it. I'm going to get into it. Give me the recipe.
Yes,
maybe we should share the recipe.
In the show notes, I'll add my recipe for my bone broth as well. You check out the links. If you don't have an Instapot, we'll put a link down there to get it.
Good idea.